From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 1-800-NOW-OPEN or open.com.
Today is the last day to help WNYC shorten the October fundraiser. Advance pledges have already shortened the drive by nearly two full days. Every contribution makes a difference. Please visit WNYC.org or pledge at 1-888-376-WNYC. And thank you.
It's another Leonard Lopate Show ticket giveaway. WNYC is supported by Brooklyn College, presenting Brooklyn on My Mind, asking the question, is there still an American novel, on Monday, October 23rd at 7 p.m. Participating in the discussion are Michael Cunningham, Colin McCann, and Francisco Goldman, and I'll be hosting. Information, 718-951-5195. WNYC has three pairs of tickets for Monday. We are giving them away now, starting with the first caller to reach us at 212-433-9692. And please note, you're not eligible for these tickets if you've won anything from WNYC in the past 30 days. Wangari Maathai was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004. Some 30 years before that, Dr. Maathai had launched Kenya's Green Belt Movement, which paid local women small salaries to plant trees in order to help restore depleted forests. Over time, the link between her efforts to restore the environment, to improve women's lives, to guarantee human rights, and encourage a democratically elected government became increasingly more obvious. She discusses the changes she's witnessed in Kenya and the ones that she's helped bring about in her new memoir called Unbowed. It's published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased and honored that it has brought Wangari Maathai to my show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
So how many trees has the Green Belt Movement planted so far in Kenya?
Well, in Kenya, we have planted, I'm sure now we are into between 35 and 40 million and counting because...
So that's over a million a year.
Yeah, we plant about that. And it we still need a lot of trees. So although they sound like many, it's still a drop in the ocean in terms of what is needed throughout the world.
Why was it necessary to grow so many trees?
Well... But as you know, most of the people who live in the countryside, especially in developing countries, still use wood as their major source of energy and wood products. And so it's very, very important to plant trees even as we cut them.
Well, some of the first trees you planted in the late 30s must be mature by now. How have you protected them, prevented them from being cut down?
Well, because we started planting trees with the women, we knew all the time that these trees have to be cut. So it's a matter of creating a balance between the number of trees you plant and those you cut. But we also educate ourselves to protect all standing trees that we don't need to cut so that we always have a large number of trees that we need for other services, such as water, cleaning the air, and such.
There's a big debate about all of this in the United States. This is not just a third world situation.
Yeah, but I guess more and more people are appreciating the fact that planting trees, protecting the land, is very, very important, and especially the debate that is, I know, partly because of the recently released film by the former Vice President Al Gore, the debate on the climate change and the global warming is a very serious issue because it affects all of us, and it doesn't matter whether you are contributing to the greenhouse gases or not. And one thing we know is that trees are some of our best friends because they help us to fix some of these greenhouse gases.
and they give us oxygen. More recently, you started an international green belt movement. Does that operate mainly in Africa?
Well, our efforts is to reach out to Africa, especially because Africa is a very fragile environment. Also partly because people there are not industrialized, so they still depend very much on the land. They therefore are tending to deforest and to remove a lot of vegetation from their land as they seek land for agricultural practices and introducing commercial agriculture that was not there before. And therefore, a lot of land is being exposed. And that is why we are very keen on Africa. We are also very keen on many other countries in the world because the certification is threatening not only Africa, but many other parts of the world. And we know that soil loss is not only in Africa. We know that in Asia, even in America, especially in the Midwest, we know that a lot of soil is lost. And we see that during the rainy seasons when our rivers turn brown because we have silt that eventually adds up in the oceans and lakes and actually does a lot of damage to marine life.
You were the first African woman and the first environmentalist to ever win the Nobel Peace Prize. Had you thought of yourself as a peacemaker before you got that call from Oslo? I would have thought perhaps more provocateur.
Well, I would say that definitely I was involved in trying to make people understand that a lot of the conflicts we have, including small conflicts, local conflicts such as we have among our own different communities, are actually due to the need for us to access and to utilize resources. The conflicts as a result of our struggle to get to share those resources. And so when we don't nourish them, when we destroy them, when we lose them, the few that are left, we fight over them. Now, whether that happens at a very local level or happens at a global level, the issue is many of the wars we fight on this planet are as a result of our inability to manage ourselves, manage our resources, and share these resources more equitably. Now, I was doing that at a local level, and I could see that many of the conflicts we have in Africa are of the same nature, but globally, it is true. And I would invite anybody really to think of, why do people fight? Why do we have wars? How can we, therefore, preempt wars? It is by learning to manage ourselves more responsibly, govern ourselves more accountably, and promote justice and equity.
You've written that in awarding you the prize, the Nobel Committee recognized the importance of a grassroots community effort. Do you see them continuing that trend with their selection this year of Mohamed Yunus, the founder of Grameen Bank, which provides microloans to poor people who want to start businesses?
Yeah, indeed. I saw that, and I know, therefore, that the Norwegian Nobel Committee is still trying to encourage the world to rethink peace and security and appreciate the fact that for us to live in peace, we must address some of these issues such as poverty, such as underdevelopment, such as equity in distribution of resources. Because without doing that, we cannot enjoy peace. So I definitely see the relationship between what they did in the year 2004, what they did last year with respect to nuclear energy, and what they have done this year in recognizing our friend and brother, Mohamed Yunus, who has used his economic education and commitment and over 30 years of service to try to improve the quality of life of some of the poorest peoples in his region.
Vasil, you started off this movement as an effort to plant trees, and then it became, in time, an advocacy group for multi-party democracy, free and fair elections in Kenya, and actually played a role in finally getting President Daniel Arap Moi, who'd run the country autocratically for 25 years, out of office in the first real multi-party elections just 2002.
Yeah, it was indeed amazing to see all the efforts of many years culminate in eventually changing the system of governance, reintroducing multi-party democracy, encouraging people to go to the polls and actually remove the dictator peacefully through the ballot, which was very, very important, especially for Africa, which was used to removing dictators through force and shedding blood and all that.
Although he still has a certain amount of influence. Recently spoke to one of Kenya's great writers who returned home after many years and was robbed. His wife was raped. It's one of the great tragedies, and he knows that it was because of his opposition to Daniel Arap Moi.
I think one of the...
Well, he says he thinks, yeah, he's pretty sure it is.
Yeah. Well, this is... We are talking about Gogewa Thiong'o, a very respected writer worldwide, and definitely in Kenya, a lot of people were pained by the tragedy that befell his wife, Jerry. And I know for sure that one of the reasons why perhaps we find ourselves in that situation is that when we, in order for us to get rid of the KANU regime, which had ruled Kenya for some 40 years, we had to come together and form a major coalition of many political parties and many differences, and many communities came together and decided we want to work together. And it was a wonderful thing to see Kenyan leaders come together and provide a forum where all people, or the majority of people in Kenya, could identify with the leadership. Unfortunately, we did make some promises to each other through a memorandum of understanding, but when we got into power, unfortunately, as sometimes happens, we did not honor that memorandum of understanding, and as a result, we split, and therefore, we have not carried the dream that the Kenyan had in the year 2004.
The only reason I brought that up is also that we have rape being used as a political weapon, and so much of your movement involves empowering women. We'll take a little break. When we come back, we'll talk more about that. My guest is Wangari Maathai, who is the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize and has written a memoir called Unbowed, which is published by Knopf. Each week until the election, we will be asking for your opinion on the issues. And this week's question is, how confident are you that your vote will be counted on November 7th? You can weigh in at WNYC.org. This is New York Public Radio, WNYC, and WNYC.org. We're back with Wangari Maathai, M-A-A-T-H-A-I, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004. Has now written a memoir called Unbowed. It is published by Knopf. So here we have a situation where you have started this environmental effort initially, and one that included women. Women are, do you think women are more attuned to the national environment, more likely to notice changes in it?
I think so, because they, in this part of Africa anyway, they are the ones who work in the field. They produce food crops, and they are the ones who look for firewood, which is the main source of energy. They are the ones who look for clean drinking water for domestic use. So when the environment is degraded and need, and these primary resources disappear, they are the first to feed it.
But they also had been largely excluded from Kenyan politics. You tried to run for parliament in the 1970s and were barred on technicality, weren't you?
That's right. And I think that for many women, not only in Kenya, but I guess throughout the world, it is still a very difficult struggle to try to make headway into the mainstream politics in order to influence policy. But the story that I tell in this book is a story of the struggle and not giving up, and knowing that for every little space we create, it will be easier for the girls that follow us, and hopefully they'll get there.
Well, I'm sure you didn't think you had much of a chance of winning when you ran against Daniel Arap Moi for the presidency in 1997. Well, that was kind of a fixed election, wasn't it?
Well, I had a lot of hope, in the sense that I knew that people wanted to have change, but unfortunately at that time, and in fact in 92 and 97, the main reason why we were defeated by President Moi was because the opposition, or the main opposition, was fragmented. And so although we lost the elections, we had actually together the largest number of votes. So that's the lesson we learned in the year 2002 when we joined N1.
In 2002, you were elected to Parliament. You now serve as Assistant Minister of the Environment. And I was thinking, who could you be an assistant to? Did the is the person on top a Nobel Prize winner?
Well, the truth of the matter is, I think that quite often people in politics do interesting things, because when you are the president in our part of the world, you have to balance ethnicity, you have to balance friendship, you have to balance association. And so I did find myself assisting. And in a way, it sometimes is very difficult, because you know what you want to do, and sometimes the minister who is in charge of your area doesn't, and it is very difficult to advise the person who is supposed to guide you.
Now, the whole thing started when you came back to Kenya after having studied abroad. Is that typical? I would think that, considering what we've said about the role of women in Kenyan society, that you were atypical from the start.
I think I was very lucky, because when you read the book, you see that my parents sent me to school at a time when girls were not going to school. And then in 1960, I had this extraordinary opportunity when Senator Kennedy, then of Massachusetts, wanted to become the president of the United States. And in the course of his politics, he and others around him at that time decided that they would like to bring African students to the United States, and I found myself benefiting from that generosity from America, and I found myself in this country during the 60s. So I was really shaped by some momentous issues around very powerful politicians. And so when I go back home, I am very energized, and I'm endowed, and I have this great feeling that human rights are important, especially because of the experience of the 60s in this country.
But so, you also noticed that the environment had been degraded, that in the time you were away, things had changed to a point where it didn't look like the country you'd left.
Precisely, because during the time that I was here in America, and let alone in Europe, my country becomes independent, and it introduces crops such as coffee and tea and sugar, and these are being produced as expansive monocultures in huge farms, and this is done at the expense of the forests and woodlots that greatly affect the countryside, and especially rivers and the soil. So, and I notice this when I go back, and I begin to see, for example, the book talks about me talking to women, and they're telling me they don't have firewood, they don't have water, and yet they come from the land where I grew up and where there was plenty of any of these resources.
And then after the independence, we had these land grabs as part of the political situation, the corruption that was there, all leading to soil erosion, changes in the streams and rivers that you noticed, partly, I assume, because you also had studied biology, so you had a scientific sensibility.
That's right. I was greatly assisted by the fact that my background in college was biological sciences, and of course, when I went back home, I was shocked by the willingness or by the greed of the leaders, and I guess, you know, as a young person, I was only in my early 20s, and I had been here in America, and I took with me, I guess, the American dream of freedom, of responsible leadership, and at that time exemplified by the great leaders like Kennedy of the day. And so I was shocked that those who had been entrusted with natural resources were privatizing them and enriching themselves with it instead of being custodians for the common good of the people.
So then you studied in Germany and came back to Nairobi, University of Nairobi, to pursue a doctorate. Didn't you become, is it true, the first East African woman to earn a PhD?
Yeah, I was really very lucky because somehow I was put in a position where I was opening doors and so I found myself being the first this, the first that. And all of that actually is a wonderful thing for a woman, but it also was a great challenge, and especially being a member of the academic staff in the University of Nairobi, where there were hardly any women in that caliber. It was very challenging.
My guest is Wangari Maathai. Her memoir, Unbowed, is published by Knopf. When did you marry Wanji Maathai?
We married in 1979, shortly after I left Germany.
So before you got your doctorate, you
had... Just before I got my doctorate. In fact, I was at that time writing my thesis, but we decided to get married. We had been friends for several years.
Had three children. But did you have a sense early on that your husband was uncomfortable being married to a woman as educated as you?
No, indeed not. Partly because he himself was educated here in America. And so I thought that he understood, but obviously he did not.
Well, when he divorced you, he told the judge that you were too educated, too stubborn, and they couldn't control you. We're talking about insult. And then so you told the judge that he was incompetent, and he threw you into jail.
That was really something. But I must say that Mwangi didn't actually say those words about being too educated and too stubborn. But that's how it came out in the press. And I think that indeed it describes the perception that the public had of this woman who had been educated in America and doesn't seem to fit into the stereotype of an ordinary African woman, which I couldn't be because of the experience I had gone to. And of course, I think the judge was also sharing the same opinion. And that's why he found me guilty, even though he had no reason. And that's why I told him he was either corrupt or incompetent.
And that was just your first brush with the law. You've had any number since. But how did you go from this to creating the group that started planting trees? There's a big leap here, isn't there?
Yeah, well, all this time that I am having brushes with the law and I'm having problems with my married life and family life, and I'm at the same time also being an academic member of staff in the University of Nairobi. All of these things are happening at the same time. When you read the book, you realize that I take you from one scene, and the next time you find yourself in another scene. They were all happening at the same time. But I found myself at the same time trying to deal with the issue of environment. And I did recognize very early on that there was a very close linkage between what was happening to the environment and the fact that I was dealing with a very corrupt and very greedy and very irresponsible system of governance.
And you wound up having a series of confrontations. First, because you learned of a government plan to allow a private company to build a skyscraper in a public park in Nairobi. Then when you won that battle, then the government continued to be more angry with you. In fact, at one point you decided not to go back because you were here on a visit to the United States and you thought it might be dangerous. And then at another point, you were charged with spreading malicious rumors, sedition, and treason after you'd contacted the media over some death threats that you'd received.
Yeah, well it was a very tumultuous time because so many things were happening at the same time. But it was all because I was trying to break this dictatorship, and I was trying to expose the corruption and the mismanagement that was very common at that time. And I think that part of the problem that they were having with me is that they couldn't understand where I had gotten this adamancy and this persistency to raise issues that men were not raising, let alone a woman. And that's why they were wondering, what kind of an African woman is this?
Well, you also spent a fair amount of time in jail on and off. You barricaded your house when they accused you of treason, and the police broke into your house, threw you into a flooded jail cell. You were hurt. Later, in another action with 50 women who were protesting that their sons had been jailed as political prisoners, you were attacked by police with clubs, knocked unconscious. This can be pretty dangerous stuff that you're doing.
Yeah. Well,
we're doing. We're hoping that Kenya has changed.
Kenya has changed a lot. I know that now it is virtually impossible to imagine those activities. But at that time, it was really necessary. For example, when we were demonstrating in Uhuru Park, it was partly to stop the government from privatizing that open green space, which was very necessary for the people of Nairobi. And at
now,
another
Uhuru means freedom, doesn't
Uhuru
it?
Uhuru means freedom.
There's a certain irony here.
There was a great irony to that. And at another time, we were trying to say that now we had introduced democratic space in Kenya, there was no reason why there should be any people in jail because of their political conscience. And I joined mothers of these men. There were about 52 men at that time who were in jail unfairly. And I joined them because I wanted to render my solidarity, and I wanted to be their spokesperson because they had asked me to. But the truth of the matter is, when you read the book, you see how it all winds. It's like a labyrinth, but it all leads to the same thing. We were searching for a better society, searching for a greater democratic space, searching for meaningful development for the greatest number of people. And I just had this wonderful opportunity to be in the forefront because, unlike many other women, I had the privilege of having the education and having traveled, say, to America.
Even as late as 1998, you had to go up against the government, this time because they tried to give 170,000 acres of Karuna Forest to their friends and cronies.
Now, that was a most irresponsible act that the government was trying to
and
do.
And was there no public outcry?
Well, the truth of the matter is, at that time, again, because of the very oppressive nature of the government at that time, very few people were willing to raise their voices. And this is partly also why I write this book, to encourage citizens to stand up for when things don't go right. Don't wait for the leaders to change. Stand up for yourself, for the rights of others, and for our environmental rights.
You've written that trees have become a metaphor for your work. They have roots in soil but reach to the sky.
So often when I'm, for example, in the forest and I look at these trees, they look to me like human beings, because you could almost talk to them. And sometimes, actually, I see them like human beings who are upside down because their roots are their mouth and the rest of the body is sticking out into the atmosphere, working as hard as can be, as I said earlier, especially fixing carbon fallouts, to turn it into wood, to turn it into food, and many other services that these trees give us. It's a wonderful symbol of hope, peace, and self-empowerment.
Now, we've only scratched the surface of the story, so we have an opportunity to go into it a lot deeper this coming Sunday at the 92nd Street Y at 7:30, when I'll be speaking with Wangari Maathai about the environment in Africa and beyond. And you can get more information about that by visiting our website at wnyc.org. Thank you so much for being with us today. Unbowed is Wangari Maathai's memoir, and it's from Knopf.
Thank you very much.
On tomorrow's show, Tony Bennett celebrates his 80th year, and he is still going strong. We'll talk about his new album of duets, which features the Dixie Chicks, Stevie Wonder, Paul McCartney, Barbra Streisand, and many others. And then on Underreported, an update on the trial of 6 foreign health professionals in Libya who face the death penalty if they're convicted of deliberately infecting over 400 children with HIV. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Melissa Egan with Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blakeney Schick. We had help today from Fran Jacobs, Sam Howard, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.